You're listening to the Ready, Set, Cloud podcast, a show about trending and difficult topics in serverless and in the cloud. Today, we're talking about event-driven architectures, the architectural pattern that's been around for decades, but still a bit intimidating for many. I brought James Eastham on the show to turn some of that fear into excitement and explain a bit beyond the fundamentals. We talk about different types of message brokers, the new cloud event standard, how to get started with events, and everything in between. Ready, set, let's go. Event-driven architectures have been around for decades, but recently have been surging in rate of adoption. As cloud providers continue to grow, so does the amount of work we do in distributed systems. Distributed systems tend to be complex and run into issues you typically don't see in on-prem software. One of the best ways to mitigate the complexity is through events. At least, so they say. I brought EDA expert James Eastham on the show to talk about the world of asynchronous programming and communicating across hundreds of thousands of containers, functions, and virtual machines via events. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Alan. That's nice intro. It's good to be here to be chatting.
Yeah, I'm really happy to have you on. I'm excited for this discussion we're about to have. You're a senior cloud architect at AWS, and you're a fantastic content creator. Tell me a little bit about how you got here.
I think I kind of took the non-traditional route into software, but actually I think it's the more and more traditional now of the self-taught kind of, I have no idea what I want to do with my life when I finish school, so I'm going to start writing code. And I actually started off doing like frontline support, answering phones, helping people, that kind of job, the really nice job. It teaches you a lot. Then did a whole lot of database administration, working with SQL Server. Not my area of my career I look back on with the most fondness. I think I've got a little bit of Stockholm syndrome, actually, with all my time working with SQL Server and Windows servers. And then I kind of worked my way up the stack. So I'm a .NET developer from my background. And then I've slowly and slowly got further and further up the stack. Started working with Lambda, serverless, almost as long as .NET's been available on Lambda. The rest is kind of history. Worked with startups for quite a while, building serverless systems for startups, and then now obviously working at AWS.
Yeah, so a senior cloud architect, that's not actually a title that I see very often at AWS. Mm-hmm. I usually see solutions architect or developer advocate. You know, I see a lot of content creators fill that developer advocate role.
Yep.
So what is it that you specifically do?
So I actually work in the professional services part of AWS. So we function much like any consulting organization on the planet, I suppose, in a sense of, you know, we work with customers directly. We're actually the big difference between us in professional services and the solutions architects is that we can actually get hands-on actually building systems for our customers. So we actually get hands-on working with people, whereas the solutions architects tend to be more high level, big picture thinking, talking about services. So we actually get hands-on and build, which is really cool sometimes, like, you know, the kind of scale and the kind of things that AWS customers are building, and then we get to get directly involved in them. So yeah, that's the big difference, really. We actually get hands-on building things.
The fun stuff, you're saying.
The fun stuff. Yeah. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. You know, as I'm sure you know, whatever the customer needs, sometimes that can be really exciting and really fun and really cool. And sometimes you could be migrating 200 Windows servers out of a data center. Like, that's the kind of things that happen as a consultant.
Yeah. You just never know in the grab bag that is professional services.
Absolutely.
So yeah, let's talk a little bit about event-driven architectures. I just want to start off, like, when we say event-driven architecture, what does that mean? And what is implied as far as the architecture goes when we're talking about that?
The way I look at event-driven architecture, and one of my favorite things about event-driven architecture is fundamentally it's a communication pattern. It's a way of systems communicating with each other. But what I think is really cool is that applies both at a technical level. You have events triggering functionality between systems, but also at like a human-to-human level. So if you think about when people started building service-oriented architectures and microservices, they'd be talking about REST APIs and making API calls. And then when you try and translate that to a business context, let's imagine for a second, Alan, you're completely non-technical, you're a business person, I'm a developer, and I'm talking to you about REST APIs and HTTP and gRPC, and you're going, huh? What does that even mean? Whereas with event-driven architecture, the fundamental thing is that it's business events triggering functionality. So I could come to you as a business person and say, Alan, what should happen after an order is created. And then as I can take that same language and actually use that in my actual applications, then I can write some code that happens after an order created event happens. So I like to think of it like that, as like a communication pattern, both at a technical level and at a human-to-human level, if you will.
I like that a lot. And I've made my career building software for both internal use and external use for integrators, meaning I have built applications that have front ends on top of them, and I've also built public-facing APIs as well for integrators to use and build their own systems. How do you feel like the complexity changes or not for integrators when you shift that mindset from something like a REST API that's very data-driven to something more event-driven that is business-focused?
The coupling is one of the biggest things in this space. When I'm an integrator and I'm integrating with something that's REST-based or HTTP-based, there's a whole lot of coupling you have there at runtime. So things like, I need to know exactly where that API is. I need to know where that API lives. I need to know its DNS name, its IP address. It's all that kind of stuff. I need to know the throughput, the limitations that API has in terms of throughput, like how many requests per second can it deal with. I need to worry about API keys, authentication. There's all these things as an integrator that I need to think about as I'm interacting with an API. Whereas when you start to shift to a more event-driven mindset, it kind of shifts these responsibilities around a little bit. So I'm a producer and I'm just publishing events, and my only responsibility is just to make sure I publish an event in a consistent format. So that's one side of the integration, is the producer, the person sending the event. And then at the other side, you as a consumer, you have complete control over your own throughput. You have complete control over your own system. You can put things in place to make sure that as events come into your system, you can control them better, as opposed to having some arbitrary third party just hammering your API with 200,000 requests a second that you didn't really expect before. Like, you're just subscribing to events that other systems are publishing in the patterns you can use. It shifts that responsibility around, so you have more control over the load hitting your system, as opposed to having just exposing an API and that API being hit.
So I noticed your vernacular changed a little bit in that description. You started saying words like producer, consumer, I don't know, you said another one in there somewhere, subscriber, there we go. And those are generally not words that you hear when you're talking about a REST-based API or just client-server architectures in general. Let's go ahead and talk about what the differences are there. Let's frame it from, I'm coming at event-driven architectures from a client-server set of architectures. How do these terms line up best you can? You know, I know they don't line up one for one. Yeah. But what is a producer? What is a consumer in words that I would know with my background?
In a typical HTTP-based thing, you'll have some kind of client making the request and you'll have some type of server receiving the request. They're the two primary components in REST-based communication. In event-driven systems, you can almost think of the client as a producer. So you'd have a client sending the HTTP request. You would have a producer publishing the event. Where in HTTP, you would have the server. In event-driven architecture, you would have a consumer or a subscriber. I tend to use them words interchangeably. If I say one or the other, I mean the other. So that's the kind of, the client is the producer, the server is the consumer. And then what you've got, you have one additional component at the core of event-driven architecture, and that's something sat in the middle. So where was client and server? The client's talking directly to the server. In an event-driven architecture, you've got your producer publishing an event onto some kind of middleware, some kind of message channel. That might be an event bus, that might be a queue, that might be a stream, but there's some kind of something in the middle that your producer is producing events onto and that your consumer is subscribing to events from.
What is the difference between all of those?
That's a good question. A message bus would typically be a central piece of software that might be something like Amazon EventBridge, that might be something like RabbitMQ in the open source world. You'd have some kind of central place that all of your producers are producing events to, and all of your subscribers are defining subscriptions from. It typically is a one-to-many type relationship. So you'd have one producer publishing an event to an event bus, and then you'd have many subscribers. So the events would then get fanned out to all the possible subscribers. Let's say you've got an order processing service that's publishing an order created event. You might have an inventory service and a delivery service and an invoicing service all subscribed to the bus. So think of event buses as doing one to many. A queue, on the other hand, is typically for more one-to-one type relationships. So I'm going to send a message, publish an event, and I want only you to receive that event, Alan. You might use a queue to do that. Queues are typically durable. Queues will hold on to the event data for as long as it takes till somebody comes and grabs that event off the queue and then actually do some work with it. So yeah, typically more point-to-point, one-to-one style integrations. And then event streams. Streams typically are a little bit of a middle ground, I suppose, is how I would think about that. So you'd still have producers publishing things onto streams. You could have multiple subscribers to that stream of events, but streams typically will have some element of durability built into them as well. So you could go back in time and replay a set of events from the stream from a certain point in time. So the three very similar use cases, and it's three very similar technologies. And in a lot of cases, you could switch one with the other. You could use a stream instead of a queue. You could use an event bus or a stream. And a lot of that is determined by exactly what it is you need in your specific requirements right now.
For sure. I think I say the phrase, it depends, in literally every episode of this podcast.
That's good.
Because it always does. It always is. It's always use case driven. It's always, you know, what's the difference with your business? What's the tolerance for faults? There's a whole lot to it that is never a generic, yes, use this for this. Let's dive in a little bit. When I started with event-driven architectures 5-6 years ago, I went to go publish my first event. And I honestly had no idea what to put in an event. It just feels like this freeform blob of, for me, it was JSON. And I didn't really understand, is there a structure that I'm supposed to follow? What goes into an event when I'm publishing? And I assume the answer, of course, is it depends. But I would actually like to hear from you, like when I'm structuring an event and I'm building something with business logic, what do I put inside of an event? Is there a standard somewhere?
There absolutely should be. Yeah. So I think this is one of the most important things to get right as you start thinking about event-driven architectures. As you said, like one of the ways you can do EDA is just to publish some random JSON and random people can subscribe to that random piece of JSON and off you go, you're doing event-driven architecture. And then you will really quickly get into a whole lot of hurt. And I've been there. I've been in this hurt where I've done exactly what you've just described and it's painful. And the reason this is so important is one of the reasons that you might want to adopt an EDA is this idea of loose coupling. I talked about it a little bit before, talking about HTTP communication, where you've got really tight coupling in that your client needs to know where your server is. And when it comes to EDA, probably the biggest part of coupling you still have between two systems is the actual event itself, right? If you publish an event and a downstream consumer is using that event, they care about the format of that event. You're still coupled at that point. So the way you structure your events is super, super important. And there's a couple of ways you can do that. As you said, there are standards out there. So there's a standard called the Cloud Events Specification. This is a really well-defined JSON structure for how you would structure your events. So as well as including the actual payload of the event, so you know an order created event is going to look different to a payment completed event, which is going to look different to an inventory updated event. So you've got your event payload, which will differ, but then you also have a set of properties or fields that are going to be in every single event that gets published. Things like the version number of the event, a unique identifier for that event, trace IDs, correlation IDs, times the event was published. There's all these standard fields that get included alongside the actual custom event payload that is order created event, order updated event, payment failed event, whatever that might be. The other pattern I really like, if you don't want to adopt the whole cloud event specification, is the metadata data pattern. So you'd split your event payload into two top level properties. So the only two properties in the top level of your JSON would be metadata and data. The data property has the actual custom event payload, and then the metadata section has this standard set of fields, the event ID, the version number, the correlation ID, the date time, et cetera, et cetera.
How does that differ really from cloud events? The way you were describing cloud events, it sounded like the majority of it was metadata. And I'm sure somewhere in there has a data property or something that actually has the message payload.
I started doing EDA, I think, before the cloud event specification was really fully fleshed out. So I've always defaulted to metadata data, but you're absolutely right. There's no real difference apart from the actual schema itself. Like it's the metadata data pattern, you've just got metadata and data. The cloud event specification is a really defined specification. I think if I was building something net new today, I would probably use Cloud Events because that is a well-defined schema. Most programming languages that I've used will have some kind of library to allow you to really easily implement the specification. I know .NET does. So that's the way I'd head, I think, if I was doing this net new. But yeah, I talk about metadata just because I've seen it a lot in the wild and I've used that myself pretty extensively.
Got it. No, that makes sense. And it's relatively new in the sense that it's production ready. I saw in February, the CNCF gave it the green light for, yes, let's all start using Cloud Events. So, you know, no fault to you for really practicing them.
I didn't actually realize it was that recent. I thought it was, it already graduated. So there we are. You taught me something today, Alan.
Yeah, I only know that because I published that in the newsletter the week that it was promoted. Okay. So that's great. You mentioned schema. Mm-hmm. Now, I assume that the schema of your events is as important as the schema or the contracts of something like a REST-based API. Mm-hmm. And honestly, for me, one of the hardest things about REST-based APIs are versioning. You know, what do you do with the path? What do you do with X, mm-hmm. Y, or Z? So what's your approach to versioning event schemas? Actually, before we get to versioning, what's your approach on documenting the schemas, mm-hmm. and then subsequently versioning them when you have to make a breaking change? And do you only version them when there are breaking changes?
So in terms of documenting, I try and fit into whatever developer platform already existed. So, you know, there's tools out there, things like Backstage. If that was already in use for the REST-based communication, I would try and integrate with a similar kind of platform. There's also specifications in the same way there is the OpenAPI specification for REST APIs. You have a similar thing for events as well, which name?
Async API.
Async API. There it is. You got it just before me. There's the async API specification that I try and store that somewhere that was easily accessible to developers so that they can find the different types of events. If you are going fully AWS native services, then EventBridge does have a feature called Schema Registry, which can automatically generate some of this documentation for you. But I'd try and fit with whatever the rest of the organization was using to not introduce a new tool just for the purposes of events. And then versioning, when I said I got into a whole lot of pain with the JSON payloads, that came specifically from not having the ability to version events. Because much the same way you do with APIs, it's a difficult thing and it's actually no easier in event-driven architecture. So like you say, I think the number one thing I'd always try and do is try to avoid breaking changes where possible, the same way you would in API. And that's kind of a given, but I thought I'd mention that try and avoid it if possible. When it comes to actually making a breaking change, because even if you think you never will, you will.
Required fields happen. They always
happen. Yeah. I think in some ways this gets maybe a little bit easier than APIs. I'd be interested to see what you think about this in terms of strategy. But the way I'd think about this is, let's say you've got version one of your already created event and you want to start publishing version two because you have a breaking change introduced. So the way I would approach this is I would start publishing both versions of the event at the same time. So whenever you publish version one of the already created event, you would also publish version two. So both versions of the events hit the event bus. And you'd make sure that your subscribers, when they define how they're going to subscribe to the events, they actually include the version number in their subscription. So rather than saying, I just want to see the already created event, you would always get the subscribers to say, I always want version one. So what'll happen is you're publishing version one and version two of this event at the same time. And at that moment in time, the version two of the event is really sad because nobody's actually caring about it. It's just kind of sat there, just being published and completely ignored. And then over time, you'd put up a comment to say, hey, everybody else in the organization, we've started publishing version two of the order created event. Here's the schema. On, I don't know, April the 1st, we're going to stop publishing version one. Can you make sure that you've all migrated over? And when you get to that date, obviously then you can turn off version one and then only publish version two of the events. And I don't know if that is easier than APIs if you're doing like versioning paths, but it feels like it kind of is, maybe.
I don't know. Really, it feels like the same because the responsibility is on the consumer of the event, really. So you as the producer, the creator, is saying, here, this changed. Can you please move over to it? Versus something where the producer is also taking it on itself to maybe do some sort of transformation on behalf of the consumer. If that was the case, then yeah, it might be a difference between mm-hmm. a REST-based API and an event. I don't know. Fortunately for me, I haven't had to do that too many times in production.
Yeah, likewise. I tend to try and avoid it as much as possible if you can. The other related thing as well is around observability and tracing. If you have good observability in place, you could start to actually look at including a subscriber side, including the version of the event that you've received as part of your distributed tracing or as part of your observability strategy, which then means as a producer, you could actually go and have a look in your observability tooling and say, okay, which systems are subscribing to this version of the event? And then you can get a little bit more targeted. You know, Alan, come on, we're depreciating this version tomorrow. Can you just please update it now? We'll give you a month's notice. So that can get quite interesting as well. And there's some interesting things you can get into if you've got the observability nailed down as well.
Two things about that I want to talk about. One is that's an interesting role that you're talking about for looking at your observability traces and seeing who the subscribers are. Because one of the benefits that I usually think of when I think of event-driven architectures is the producers don't know or care about the subscribers. And what you just described it's very interesting because it doesn't almost fit into that paradigm of producer and consumer, because you kind of want an overarching view of how many consumers do I have on this event that I'm producing. And the question here, I do actually have a question, is that a defined role when we're talking about event-driven architectures? Is this overarching puppeteer, if you will, a term in EDA? Or is that something that we just do as part of programming these days?
Yeah, there is a term. The first thing I'll say, I suppose, with that strategy of starting to include that in your observability, the same rules still stand. The producers don't know or care about the subscribers to their events. It just gives you the opportunity, the ability to be able to go and see that information if you need to. If you do truly need to have this puppeteer, if you will, the term we would use for that would be orchestration. So typically, event-driven architecture is talked about as being more choreography, in that you've just got events that are being published and things that are reacting to them. Having something centrally that's managing things and saying, okay, you do some work, order processing service, then warehousing service, you do some work, and then invoicing service, you do some work, that is more orchestration. You've got this central thing that's orchestrating. So that's not what I'm talking about when I talk about including trace information and versioning in the tracing, but that is another thing that you often see in event-driven architectures, is you have some element of orchestration in places as well.
So just kind of an aside here, the word choreography when we're talking about EDA has always confused me, because I hear the word choreography and I think of dancing. I think what most people think of when they hear that word. Mm-hmm. And knowing the next steps in a choreographed dance very much to me sounds orchestrated. It's this and then this and then this and then that. So is there a parallel between the word as we know it as it relates to dancing and event-driven architectures?
I think the parallel with dancing, is where I see it, is that each individual person has the potential to do their own thing. I think it does start to fall down when you get into an actual full dance routine. But that's the way I look at it, is like each individual person has its own thing that it's doing, and the beats of the music determine what an individual person does. So if you've got a dance routine, you've got 10 dancers and each 10 people has their own. One's doing backflips, one's doing cartwheels, one's doing some weird little jiggy thing, then they would be all reacting to the same music in a different way, whereas orchestration is
like a line dance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But full disclosure, I think I'm stretching that analogy there.
That's more than what I've been going off of, so I'll accept that as an acceptable answer. Let's get to the other part of my question for what you had said. And it's really about observability when we're talking about EDA. And I'm going to start my question with a story of the very first time that I had something go wrong in an event-driven architecture, where I was actually building a jailing application. So when somebody is picked up by the police and goes to jail, the very first thing that they do is they go to something called booking, where the police, you know, take their fingerprints and take their mugshot. I was building a system that did that. And it was event-driven, where the police officer would start an event and then it would be picked up by booking and essentially put into a queue so the people in the booking office knew that there was somebody coming. And the very first time I ran into an issue with EDA, there was not an item in that booking queue that should have been in that booking queue. And it was terrifying. Yeah. And I didn't have a whole lot of experience with event-driven architectures. I didn't know. Like, there was no way for me to figure out where that data went, because I came from a background where it's very, very easy to see logs in an API request where this invocation went and there was an error and I logged the error. But when something doesn't get delivered with an event, I just had no idea. And I really was just forced to say, I'm sorry, this isn't here. I'll work on fixing it in the future. So what are the steps, or how is it different when we're talking about troubleshooting issues with event-driven architectures?
Mm-hmm. That's the big trade-off, isn't it? When you talk about loose coupling, the downside of loose coupling is that cause and effect gets really, really hard, because producers don't know about subscribers. Subscribers don't know about producers. How do you know who called what and who did what, when and why? And this is where it kind of does come back to this schema, this idea of having a defined schema or the metadata in your schema. Because one of the only ways you can determine cause and effect is by passing some common identifier of some kind or some common piece of information between each event. So let's imagine an actual workflow. So the request comes from a front end to a back end. That's almost always still going to be HTTP. And at that point, an event gets published. Let's stay with the e-commerce example. It's an order created event. As part of that order created event, you will include some kind of identifier. That might be a correlation ID. It might actually be a trace ID if you're using something like OpenTelemetry, but you'll include a piece of data in there. You could even return that back to your front end. So you've got that correlation ID for troubleshooting from the front end. That order created event then goes into an event bus. A subscriber grabs that order created event and they're going to use that correlation ID, that piece of data that was passed in some way. They might use it as part of their structured login. They might continue a trace. They might link two traces together using that correlation ID. And then that service goes on and publishes a payment confirmed event. And they'll include that same correlation ID that came from the very edge of the system in that event. And that way, that does obviously rely on the subscribers actually using that piece of data. Like there is a bit of responsibility on you as a subscriber to actually use it, but it gives you the potential to be able to track an individual request through the entire system. So that's how I like to think about it. At the very edge, the very boundary of the system, that's probably going to be a REST API still, generate something at that point and ensure that gets passed at every point down the chain. And then it just relies on some implementation details to get that into somewhere that's sensible.
This to me feels like one of those not as pretty trade-offs when you're going from request response to event-driven architectures. Obviously, there's a lot of benefits that you get, but this is one of the ones that feels a little bit more difficult.
Definitely, yeah. I was doing some work last night. I'm working on a course at the minute on building microservices, and I'm starting from like HTTP-based microservice communication. And I set up two microservices last night, OpenTelemetry, ran them both, and I could just see cause and effect. The tracing just worked. Like OpenTelemetry is so mature now. And when I think about the code I've written inside like a Lambda function to actually take a message off a queue from an event bus, wire up the tracing, pull the correlation ID out of the message, I'm like, wow, yeah, this is more involved for sure, like as opposed to just making a HTTP request, like you said. And you can just see that this service called this service. I was going to say easy then, but that feels like the wrong word to use. It's more straightforward, I suppose, to be able to understand what's calling what.
Yeah, that reminds me of a quote that I stole from somebody a long time ago that I wish I remember who I stole it from, because I'd love to give them credit because I say it a lot. And it's, don't confuse unfamiliarity with complexity. And that's one of the things that I think a lot of people struggle with when we're talking about modern cloud practices is the unfamiliarity or the uncharted territory of distributed systems, of network failures that you may or may not see, of event-driven architectures. It all feels incredibly complex. And honestly, it's more complex than stuff that we've done before, but it's probably not as complex as it first looks when you're getting on the stage for the first time. It takes a little bit of practice to understand, okay, these are the new moving parts versus the moving parts that I've seen in the past.
Yeah. I mean, I think in some ways you're just shifting the complexity around, aren't you? Like, at least from my experience building with event-driven architectures, the actual individual pieces of compute, like you just receive an event, you do some work very specific to that event, and then you publish another event. I'm really oversimplifying that, but you know, the bits of compute become reasonably simple, and it's then you're shifting that complexity into the points of integration and understanding the integration between components. So big bucket of trade-offs, as always.
Always. So we're running a little bit low on time, and I want to wrap this up with one more question based on what we were just talking about. And for people that want to start EDA for the very first time, what would you recommend as that first step? What is your recommendation for the best approach to get started? What is step one?
Oh, step one. I'd have two different step ones. If you're an individual person, you're just interested, you want to just start trying out how to build an event-driven architecture, I would just get in and start building. So look at AWS services, serverless services like Lambda and EventBridge, where you can just hook these things together relatively straightforward. You can hook these things together relatively simply, and then you can just go off and actually start building it and look at how you can write code that incorporates the cloud event specification or the metadata. Look at how you define a subscriber against EventBridge. Get these kind of basic building blocks in place of producer, middleware, subscriber, go off and start building. The second starting point I would have is that if you're as part of an existing organization or a larger enterprise who's trying to adopt EDA at an enterprise level, And at that point, you want to start with techniques like event storming. The first thing you want to understand is the actual events you have in your business. You want to start from the actual events themselves, understand what events trigger what other events, design the schemas of your events in the same way you might design an API. To do API first design, you might do event first design. Get all your events in place, the schemas of your events, before you actually start building, and then you can go off and look at starting to implement that. So yeah, I'd probably differ that based on exactly where you are in your EDA journey.
I love that step one is even and it depends.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
That wasn't intentional, but yeah, there we go.
So James, thank you very much. This has been a super informative session. I hope our listeners are really excited and invigorated about event-driven architectures. It's fundamentally changed the way I've approached programming over the past few years, and I love it. Never looking back. So much easier to hook into systems, to fan out things, you know, because user expectations are changing every single day. They expect things to be faster, and they expect more things to be done pretty much every day. Unfortunately for programmers, user expectations never really get easier. It's always more difficult, faster and more. Event-driven architecture really lends itself well to that mindset of let's just continue to get faster and let's continue to do more for you automatically. So thank you for coming and talking to us. If people want to reach out to you and learn more, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
I'm pretty active on social, so Twitter and LinkedIn is where I tend to spend most of my time. I'm Plant Powered James on Twitter, James-Eastham on Eastham. I can't even say my own name, Eastham. On LinkedIn, they're probably the best places to reach out to me. I do also do a whole lot of content on YouTube. I'm at Serverless James on YouTube. I've got a whole series ongoing at the minute on patterns of event-driven architecture for fundamental building blocks outside of specific services, specific implementation details, like the kind of fundamentals of EDA. So YouTube, Twitter, LinkedIn. They're the places where I'm normally pretty active. Oh, and Discord, the Believe in Serverless community on Discord, actually, to throw a shout out in there. I'm pretty active on Discord as well.
Yes, you are. And I will link all of those things for our listeners in the show notes so they can get a hold of you if they need to. So once again, thank you, James. This has been super informative and I love the conversation. So thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks for having me.
All right, we'll talk to you later. That's it for this episode of the Ready, Set, Cloud podcast. Thanks for joining me, and remember to follow the show wherever you listen to podcasts. This is Alan Helton, and we're out of here.